My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Almost every faith on earth has a version of the Golden Rule. In essence, it instructs us to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In our hectic and challenging world today, most people practice a variation. I'll do unto you and owe myself one. Why is it so easy to extend love, compassion, and caring to others and not do the same for ourselves? What events in our lives programmed our brains to react this way? And is there a way to reprogram them to extend to ourselves the same loving kindness we extend to others and know that we are worthy to receive it? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Rick Hansen, says there is a way back to self-love and self-compassion. Rick is a psychologist, a senior fellow of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, and a New York Times best-selling author. Available in 26 languages, Hardwiring Happiness, Buddha's Brain, Just One Thing, and Mother Nurture are among the titles. An invited speaker at NASA, Oxford, and Harvard, he has also taught in meditation centers worldwide. He joins me this week to discuss his latest book, co-authored with his son, Forrest Hansen, called Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. Please welcome to Destination Unlimited, Rick Hansen. Good evening, Rick.
Victor, I'm so happy to be here, and I want you to announce all my books ever, always, in the future.
Sir, it would be my privilege and pleasure to do so. Wow. So when we welcome a guest to Destination Unlimited for the first time, we like to find out a little about the events in their lives that shaped their paths. Please share yours with us.
Well, so many. I really, when I look back, two things stand out in my childhood, actually, that now, 50 years later, really, I reflect on a fair amount. The first was that in my earliest memories, which go back to being probably about 2 years old, certainly by 3 years old, there was a sense in the background, a kind of poignant, wistful sadness that there was so much unnecessary unhappiness around me. And to be clear, I grew up in relatively privileged, fortunate circumstances. I would kind of give my childhood in many ways kind of a C minus altogether, nothing too horrible. And yet I saw a lot of unnecessary, I knew in my bones as a little kid, it just was unnecessary for there to be that much hassling, fussing, feuding, criticizing and worrying. I just knew that. And like many children, including very little ones, you know things that are true, even if you can't really put them into words yet. But that kind of haunting, wistful longing was right there with me from the beginning. That was both a sensitivity to suffering and a wish to find out what to do about it. And then the second thing that really landed on me when I am looking back now happened in my teens. It was right around, I know I was about 15 because I was reading the book Dune, a sci-fi classic, and the main character was 15 as well when the book started. And the takeaway from that book, and more generally, was about the primacy of growth, of growing. In other words, learning, developing, acquiring skills, acquiring capabilities, letting go of old crud, acquiring new good things. And I just got that no matter how bad my past had been, and no matter how unpleasant my present was, I could always each day help myself grow a little bit, learn a little bit how to talk to girls, learn a little bit how to deal with my own thoughts and feelings, learn a little better how to navigate, you know, my parents and my family system. That was something I could do every day. And when that really landed in me, it seemed incredibly hopeful. And it also then started turning my attention toward you could say, meta skill of how to acquire skills. In other words, meta learning, learning how to learn. How do we get good at getting good, in other words. And those two, I think, they were, it wasn't like a white light moment. It wasn't like I was that self-conscious about this. But yet, if I look backwards, I can see that those two were major factors in my eventual development into a psychologist with a deep interest in both contemplative practice and brain science.
Now, you and I are contemporaries, and we both grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And with the advent of the 70s, it brought the New Thought movement. How did that affect you?
I caught the cresting wave of the human potential movement at the tail end of the 60s and the early 70s. And it was fantastic. It drew me into both cutting edge psychology, especially humanistic psychology and human potential generally. And it also drew me into the Eastern traditions, particularly the one that drew me most was Buddhism, especially its early original forms, because they seemed in their essence to be so direct, not caught up in a lot of cultural trappings and complexities that I didn't necessarily relate to, but in their kind of piercing, penetrating clarity about the importance of recognizing the radical transience of each moment and the futility and the suffering in the doom strategy of sort of holding on to and grasping and trying to keep from oneself what is continually changing right under our noses. So that kind of launched me on my way. And then in the mid-70s, toward the end of the 70s, as I began to approach my 30th birthday, I realized, whoa, I better get some legitimate credentialing here, or I'm going to be hungry or something. So that sent me back to graduate school, and initially in developmental psychology, because I've always been interested in children and in roots, origins. Because what's the line? As the sapling doth incline, so doth the tree grow, or something like that. And then that took me further into graduate school, and a PhD before I was 40.
And the apple does not fall far from the tree, at least.
I think that's usually pretty true. That's right.
Now, we posed the question in our introduction this evening as to why many people so readily extend kindness and compassion to others and yet deny themselves the same. Why do you think that's
true? I think it's for multiple reasons. Part of it's cultural, and then in general, in terms of Western culture, distinct from more Eastern cultures. And the other kinds of reasons, I think, have to do with personal upbringing, but also more generally what scientists call the brain's evolved negativity bias. So my super short response to each of those elements is that Western culture tends to be goal-directed, and so if we don't yet have attained our goals, then we feel like, oh, something's wrong with me, I have fallen short. And with social media, as my son puts it, we routinely compare the movie of our whole lives whose warts we know well with the carefully edited highlight reel of everybody's wonderful girlfriend or vacation or recent accomplishment on Facebook. So that's one reason. And then a second reason is that some families are particularly oriented toward criticism, shaming, and also and perhaps a value on dismissing one's own needs and minimizing them. And we tend to do to ourselves as adults. We're designed neurologically and through biological evolution to do to ourselves what others did to us, especially when we were young and vulnerable. So that's a second reason. And then third, we have the negativity bias of the brain, which I summarize as that we have a brain that's like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. In other words, experiences one after the other in which we feel like we blew it, or we fell short, or others were critical, or they rejected us or left us out. So, well, obviously something must be wrong with me. We tend to accumulate those residues preferentially in neural storage, literally hardwired into the body. While meanwhile, experiences of worth, of accomplishment, of deserving good care and attention, of deserving love, of being a decent and good person, those may be occurring, but they wash through the brain like water through a sieve because they're not that useful in terms of raw survival back in the Serengeti Plains or even farther back in Jurassic Park, right? 65 or 100 million years ago when dinosaurs really did rule the earth. So those are the major reasons. And I think that to finish, it's really important to know that each person can implement correction You can draw on very simple tools that I explore in my book, Resilient, and in other means. You can draw on really simple tools to authentically grow a sense of worth and deserving of love, which actually makes people less arrogant, typically, and makes them more resilient and more able to handle the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
You mentioned social media or digital communication, especially with millennials. Do you think it's dangerous?
Short answer is, I think there are blessings and curses. I appreciate the internet. You and I are connecting right now through Skype. There's a lot about that. On the other hand, the brain is very vulnerable to being trained to be hungry for rapid stimulation and cascades of stimulation. And I do fear that many young people are forming relationships that are maybe a mile wide but an inch deep, and are also getting addicted, frankly, to intense incoming streams of stimuli, so that anything short of that feels like breathing through a straw. You can kind of get enough air, but you always feel like you want more. And that's a concern as we go into the 21st century now.
And what about our ability to communicate with one another? You and I grew up in a day where conversation and the written word in books was so important. Yeah. And now people are just sort of distaff and apart with their digital communication.
It concerns me. I know we're coming on a break, so I'll be quick here, and we might get into more of this later. But if you really think about it, we're designed psychologically through the hot forge of evolution for living in a band of about 30 other adults our entire lives, with some kids and old people around the edges. And that's the framework in which we're adapted. And it's only really in the last 10,000 years with agriculture, and then really the last 50 years with modern communications technology, that we're shifting into a radically different mode of being. That's like a vast experiment that, with very little thought to the consequences, we're designed to relate through touch and through sight. And these other more distant means have their advantages. You know, I like being able to communicate with our daughter 3,000 miles away, but long-term, I'm really concerned with the consequences.
My guest is Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. We'll be back with Rick and more of this after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for Inspired Conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired Conversations, to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Psst, Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Ugh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. So, Rick, your techniques combine neuroscience, psychology, and mindfulness. Most of our listeners are familiar with the latter two, but may not be familiar with neuroscience, and in particular, the concept of neuroplasticity. Please tell us about these.
Oh, sure. Well, we all encounter neuroplasticity each day as we learn or remember things of one kind or another. So, for example, depending on when people are listening to this, they might consider their memory of the most recent meal or something that happened to them the previous week or some way in which they have grown or developed over the last month or two or three, become a little calmer, a little stronger, a little happier, a little wiser, perhaps. These are forms of personal growth, healing, and learning that must involve some kind of underlying change in the body. And otherwise, we're left with magic. Now, I believe in magic, broadly speaking, but most of, if not all of, our consciousness has to do with underlying physical processes we actually share with our cousins. I look out the window, I see the squirrels in the trees near our home. I think those squirrels are seeing and hearing, much as I'm seeing and hearing right now. Their brains are not as complex as mine, so their experiences are not as complex as mine. But there's a great kinship that we have with all life, which, of course, has moral implications as well as scientific ones. So the bottom line is that much as I teach routinely as a meditation teacher and other people do as well, much as in some sense we can focus a lot on mindfulness of the body, that's really valuable. But objectively, we are body full of mind. That's actually the truth of things. Moment by moment by moment by moment, the body is actually making the mind. And so if you understand a little bit about how your body is making your mind, notably the 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue inside the coconut, your brain, then you can intervene skillfully. You can use your mind alone in terms of where you place attention and then what you do with what your attention is resting upon. You can use your mind alone to stimulate the underlying neural circuitry that is involved with whatever you're paying attention to that's beneficial, wholesome, and usually enjoyable. And by stimulating the neural circuitry that underlies the kind of strengths or inner resources of various kinds one might want to grow, including happiness or spiritual evolution, by strengthening those neural substrates in the body, by stimulating those neural substrates in the body, you strengthen them. There's this famous saying, neurons that fire together, wire together. Mm. So the longer you keep them firing and the more you feel that in your whole body, the more they're going to tend to wire together as well. Fundamentally, to finish, you can use your mind to change your brain, to change your mind for the better.
So it almost sounds like we can exercise and build the brain in a similar way to exercising our bodies.
Extremely good analogy. It's a very good analogy. You have to do the work. On the other hand, no one can stop you in the sacred temple, your innermost being, from helping yourself learn as much as you can from the experiences you're having and from doing what you can to shape the experiences that you will be having so you can learn as much as possible from them when they come to you. No one can stop you from doing that, but no one can do that for you, which for me is really wonderful. It's actually very old school. What you and I are talking about here, Victor, is to me the essence of self-reliance, which is more important than ever these days, when it's clearer than ever these days that at least in the immediate future, it doesn't look like the cavalry is coming. Yeah. And more it's important for people to build up resources from the inside out.
Slightly off topic, but pertinent to folks who are my age and perhaps your age and a little bit older, does there come a point where that neuroplasticity decreases?
That's really an interesting hot question. So there are certain periods of life, the first 3 years or so, and then the teen years, when the brain basically says to its environment, change me, change me. I'm here to be maximally shaped by whatever you do. So things that happen during those periods are really important, certainly. That said, as we get older, we remain certainly able to grow and to change and to develop, as we can see in the example of people that we may know personally who continue to learn and to develop and grow all the way, frankly, into their 90s or even beyond. So evidence of mental change is evidence of neural change, fundamentally. And even though neuroscience is a baby science, there's a tremendous amount of evidence in both psychology and kind of ordinary experiences with people of tremendous development over time of people's psychology. People really can become happier, wiser, stronger, more loving. They actually can learn to play the piano in their 90s, for example. And that means, therefore, that the opportunities for personal development and even transformation go across a lifetime. And in fact, sometimes older people are better learners because they're more motivated and they know how to help themselves learn. And to leave you with a little thought here that I find quite haunting and profound, after your heart has beat its last beat, still for several minutes, maybe 5, 10 minutes or longer, there continues to be some metabolic activity inside your brain. Synapses are firing, the connections between neurons, new little tendrils of neurons are starting to grow toward each other. There are ebbs and flows of neurotransmitters. There still might, in principle, be opportunities for development and healing and transformation, even as the lights slowly go out in the mansion of the brain and the mind.
That's a beautiful analogy. Just out of curiosity, have there been any studies showing that people who work on exercising their neurons, on neuroplasticity in their younger years, are less prone to degenerative diseases of the brain, and even perhaps Alzheimer's?
That is, a really interesting question. There's not a lot of clear research on it. We have, you may know, the so-called Nunn study. These are longitudinal studies that showed that even when you control for a lot of variables, people who were mentally active in their youth, including things like trying to learn a new language or how to knit or play bridge, things like that, were less vulnerable to dementia even in older age. I've also heard anecdotal accounts of people who trained their minds and therefore their brains with mindfulness and other forms of strengthening what are called the executive functions of the brain, which tend to be attacked in dementia, the capacity to observe your own thinking, step back from it, and make different choices, and also kind of break complex problems down into parts and then assemble the results into a greater synthesis and so forth. Well, there is some evidence that people who, after they passed away, for one reason or another, who are autopsied, and the people doing the autopsies found physical evidence of dementia, such as Alzheimer's and those kind of plaques and tangles in the brains. And yet, in turn, these people who had practiced a lot of mindfulness and meditation and so forth, they had no evidence. There was no evidence, really, of any kind of dementia from them. So it's possible, it's certainly possible, that training early in life, or beginning early in your 60s, 60 is the new 40, right? That's good. I'm in my 60s, so I hope this is true. But anyway, that whatever the past has been, starting now can certainly help, and it certainly can't hurt.
You would think that there would be an advocacy for people who are in their 50s and 60s to get into some type of practice and to slow down degenerative processes.
I think there's a lot in our culture, right, that prioritizes physical over mental. And what I mean by that is just a detail. The actual research-proven benefits of psychotherapy for depression and anxiety disorders are generally stronger and more lasting, on average, than the results of medication. And often a combination of methods works best for different people. And I'm not trying to argue against antidepressants. I've known people who benefited from them and so forth. But the larger point I'm making is you never see ads for psychotherapy on TV. But these days in America, we're routinely pounded by ads that have to do with a physical intervention. And I kind of laugh sometimes that if you want to sell used cars, just bring a white lab coat. Wear that lab coat, even drape a stethoscope around your neck. And the authority that comes from that in this culture is going to enable you to sell more cars. So, we do tend to privilege the physical over the mental. That said, based on solid research, if you want to help yourself age gracefully and, over long haul, get exercise, eat reasonably well, don't drink too much alcohol. Okay, those sorts of things are sensible. But in terms of actual large-scale impact on health outcomes, stimulate your mind by staying interested in the world and engaging in complex activities like listening to your show. That's a good thing to do, and then talk about it with friends. And also emphasize positive emotion. Happiness is skillful means. Happiness buffers us from the negative effects of stress. Stress is inflammatory. It really wears down the body in a variety of ways. Authentic positive emotions such as your gratitude or awe or love or hanging out with your grandchildren or doing some form of spiritual practice with other people or just laughing with your friends while you ruin a round of golf. That kind of thing is also going to protect your body and offer an independent contribution to longevity. I think that if people knew the negative effects of just ruminating on the negative, they would be much more motivated not to do it and instead shift their attention to what's authentically positive for themselves and others.
Any difference between men and women?
Many differences. That's a controversial topic. Maybe we'll pick that one up. But you mean in terms of the brain?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a minefield. And a key question is, of course, even if we find, and there are some differences that have been found in an average male versus an average female brain, let's say in the 30s and 40s. But the question is, how much of that is due to nature and how much is due to nurture? It's pretty complicated. And I will just leave you with a thought that was offered to me a long time ago. I've kept thinking about it many times since. The similarities are greater than the differences. And I think for me, that's a fundamental takeaway with regard to gender.
Absolutely. My guest this evening, Dr. Rick Hansen, is the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. Rick, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
Oh, thank you. Well, the book's available widely. It's well-reviewed. It's doing reasonably well. And probably the best way to learn more about me is simply at my website, Rick Hansen, H-A-N-S-O-N, rickhansen.net. And there on my website are tons and tons of freely offered resources of various kinds, talks, videos, neat meditation, scientific papers, and a variety of other resources, as well as information about the book, Resilient. And that's where I would suggest people go, rickhansen.net.
And we'll be back with more of Rick after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going OM? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers, pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. Rick, you say that each human being has three basic needs that stem from our evolutionary history. What are those needs and how do we fulfill them?
Right, that's great. Well, if we're going to be resilient, that means that we're able to meet our needs. Resilience is in reference to meeting needs in the service of ultimately well-being. Resilience is a means to an end. So resilience is what helps us cope with trauma and terrible loss, but it also helps us keep on going in everyday life in the face of challenges and setbacks of various kinds. Resilience, it's not just for surviving the worst day of your life, it's for thriving, really, every day of your life. So that's resilience, and it's in reference to meeting your needs. Well, what are your needs? The view, kind of a summary view in biology and psychology, is that as an overarching framework, it's a simplification, but it's kind of a useful fiction. As an overarching framework, we have fundamental needs that we share with all other animals, and in some loose sense of this, with plants too. We have needs for safety. You gotta live to see the sunrise. We have needs for satisfaction. You gotta get your next meal. And we have needs for connection, whether it's purely procreative connection or the complex forms of relatedness, let's say, of a high school senior getting ready for a prom. So those are our fundamental needs. And what's interesting is to be aware of those needs operating in the moment and feeling challenged in different ways. For example, anxiety or anger typically is a signal of needs for safety. A sense of disappointment or frustration or drivenness tends to indicate opportunities for satisfaction. And a sense of loneliness or resentment or inadequacy indicates challenges to our connection needs, and including the ways that we form a sense of worth, which is where this show began, a lot, especially in childhood, to our relationships with others. So we have these needs that gives us a kind of way to be more mindful of ourselves moment to moment. And it also gives us a roadmap for identifying the resources inside ourselves that would help us the most these days to grow. Because if you have safety issues, for example, if you're anxious by temperament, or you're dealing in a situation that's kind of threatening, maybe you've got a partner who could be abusive, or you're living in a dangerous setting altogether, it's not going to be useful to do gratitude practice. That's nice. That meets your needs for satisfaction, but it's not going to help you manage your anxiety, say. And so it's important to think about where am I challenged these days, and what would be useful to grow? And then as I go into very thorough detail in the book, when you know what you're trying to grow, then you can look for ways to have experiences of it, which then you internalize and you literally hardwire the residues of those experiences as lasting changes in your nervous system that are the basis for the development of resources like grit, gratitude, compassion, and so forth. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll just say about that, which for me is really cool, is just because there's a challenge to a need doesn't mean necessarily that we need to get stressed about it. I've had a lot of experience rock climbing, standing on little edges, the width of a pencil or half the width of a pencil, or a pencil lead actually sometimes. And hazardous situations, definitely keyed up, hearts beating, some anxiety around the edges. But meanwhile, I was having the time of my life. I knew I was able to deal with these challenges with a friend holding my rope. I had gear. I was competent as a climber. Just because we're challenged in some way doesn't mean that it needs to penetrate to the core of our being. That's why I say in the book, it's so important to grow an unshakable core of calm strength and capability and happiness and love and wisdom. I'll call it well-being broadly, so that the challenges of life, the waves of life, meet that core, that unconditional core of calm well-being. And then on the basis of that core inside you, that's how you deal with the challenges, rather than feeling invaded or hijacked continually by what's coming at you. And that difference is the difference that makes all the difference in the world.
You know, you mentioned rock climbing, an interesting story. Mm-hmm. I had never had a fear of heights until I was in my mid-20s.
Yeah.
And I was helping a friend repair a roof on the house. There was a ladder, and I knew the ladder was there, and unbeknownst to me, someone moved the ladder.
Uh-oh.
I stepped down to the ladder, and the ladder wasn't there, and I fell approximately two stories. Fortunately, was not. I had bumps and bruises, but nothing broken, no serious injuries. But from that point forward, fixation about being not protected at heights, let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's the negativity bias right there. You are very smart, monkey. One trial learner, we call it, in studies of rats, you know, that you just took one time, once burned, twice shy. And yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. And just by analogy, that was adaptive, you know, generally. But think about the analog to that interpersonally. One moment of a critical parent snapping at us, or one moment of a coach or a teacher shaming us in front of other people, one moment of rejection in a group of people or from a partner, one moment of betrayal, and then, to quote one of my clients, she said about something that happened early on in her marriage, my heart closed up, and it's never opened all the way since, ever since. Yeah. So, and then the question becomes, how do we unlearn those old negative patterns and replace them increasingly with positive, adaptive, more autonomous ones?
I just want to say that I did rewire myself, and I overcame that, employing safety means, and I sometimes I'm on high steel, and I always make sure I have my safety belt and my harness in place. And so by using the standard safety methods, I've
sort of
reorganized and regained my confidence in being at heights and not being afraid of being at heights.
What do you do high up on steel?
I actually, in my day job, I've been in the welding and industrial supply industry for 39 and a half years, and most of my customers put steel buildings up, like the big buildings in Manhattan, major cities and things.
Wow. Like
they build bridges, they build buildings, they take them down, and I've been up, and I've been under, and around. And, about getting up to the high places, as long as I'm wearing the proper gear. So.
Yeah, I feel much the same way.
Personal protective equipment, that's the key to that. In all of the steps that you have in working with these four ways of recognizing the basic needs, compassion is the first step. How do we rewire ourselves for self-compassion?
A deep, deep question. I think the first step is to be aware of what compassion is. It sounds fancy, but it's simply that reaction we have, let's say, when we see a child trip and fall and skin her knee. Oh. It's just very natural. You feel for her. She may not be your best friend. We can have compassion for people without waiving our rights and without necessarily agreeing with them or even approving of them. For me, a kind of personally useful journey has been to find compassion for those who have wronged me. Not to be a doormat or to not seek justice, but actually to free myself, because I don't ever get free in relationship to those who have truly mistreated me, unless I find some compassion for them. That's been my personal experience. So it helps to recognize what is the nature of compassion and why is it useful, and then realize as well, why is it helpful to apply it to yourself? And that's where a little knowledge of the research can come in, because the myth about self-compassion, you know, is feeling sorry for oneself or feeling pitying of oneself or sympathetic toward oneself, actually makes us stronger, not weaker. Obviously, there are some people who just go way too far. They kind of wallow in self-pity, woe is me, trying to, you know, manipulate others for support. But I've known very few people like that, actually. Most of the time, I know people who, as you began this show, are kind to others. They really practice the golden rule, but only as a one-way street. They treat others well, but they don't treat themselves in the same kind of way. And that's unfortunate, because if you bring that quality, which is usually fairly brief, typically a breath or two in length or less, if you bring that quality of recognizing truly what's happened to you, the burden you're carrying, the issue you're dealing with, the pain in your body, the loss, the mistreatment that's actually occurred, perhaps, whatever it is, if you recognize that justly, much as you would recognize the injustice, let's say, that occurred to somebody else, and also then as you bring a kind of warmth to yourself, this is the essence of compassion. It's an empathic warmth that you bring to yourself with a sense of support. Actually, that makes you tougher. It makes you more able to bounce back from loss, makes you more able, as studies show, to come back from a combat zone, say in the Middle East, and not be traumatized by it. Sure, it was horrible, but there's not a lasting trauma from that, all that. And also, this kind of self-compassion is an antidote to harsh self-criticism. And therefore, people who are more self-compassionate are more willing and able to pursue ambitions, to dream big dreams, because they're not so afraid of falling short.
You know, it's interesting. When I was a kid, my father took ill when I was young. And I became part of his healing team with my mother when I was 8 years old. And when I say his healing team, he had been an amputee because of diabetes. He had stroke in his wheelchair and ravages. And I never really felt loved by him until I'd part of that healing team. And my young mind equated that if you care for others, then you receive love. And it really set me up for a long part of the relationships that I would seek would be, what can I do for you to make you love me until I love myself? And it took a long time to do that. My late 30s is when I finally woke up and started feeling that self-compassion and self-love. It was hard learned.
That's very touching, and good on you that you developed in that way. A lot of people don't.
Yeah, I think I had to. I think the feeling of self-worth came around, and I said, you know what, I can take care of others, but I also have to take care of myself. And not only from the emotional standpoint, but also from a physical standpoint, taking care of my own health as well as taking care of the health of those I love. My guest this evening is Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. And we'll be back with more of Rick after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
Hi, this is Julie Geigel.
And I'm Susan Schuler.
And I'm Lori Walker.
And we are
the Psychic Angel Channelers
from Angel Talk Tuesday.
Tune in every week at 10 a.m. Eastern on OmTimesRadio.com.
The angels have heard your call and are here to help.
Are you ready to receive?
Bathe in the beautiful vibrational frequency to help you heal, expand, and remember your magnificence with Angel Talk Tuesday.
Have you bought into the idea that you have to work hard for your money, that business is hard? I will share some dynamic access consciousness tools to get you out of your own way so you can create a business that actually succeeds. Join me, Simone Millicent, on The Joy of Business at 4 p.m. Mondays Eastern.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You accidentally cut your daughter's bangs unevenly. Do you A, line things up a centimeter from her hairline?
Man, oh man.
No, sweatbands are so hot right now. Everyone's wearing them, like that basketball player and that other basketball player.
B, get spiritual.
Mom, where did all the mirrors go?
A reflection could never capture our true selves.
Huh?
Beauty is within.
C, look on the bright side.
Less time blow drying, more time texting.
Or D, show empathy.
Mom, you really don't have
to. Ta-da! Twinsies!
I kind of love it. As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information, contact You Gotta Believe at YouGottaBelieve.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council. You don't know
what... Knowing your breasts can save your life. Go to KnowYourGirls.org for the facts you need on breast health. Brought to you by Susan G. Coleman and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. Rick, many people who are troubled lose their faith in their spiritual practices, in other people, and in life in general. They feel so battered by life's difficulties that they can't step into a more positive life. How do you answer those who feel they have no hope?
Well, first, I start by letting them land in my heart. I think that's the most important step and the first step to let others really land in our heart and for oneself to let one's own losses, dark nights of the soul, despair, land in one's own heart, which though calls for having the resources inside that have been developed over time that can help one do that. Resources like mindfulness or being able to calm oneself down or step back from one's reactions without being swept away by them. So I think that's the first thing, is to tell the truth about what has actually happened. Minimally tell the truth to yourself. If you can, tell the truth to your friends and allies. And if you've been wronged, if someone's done you dirt, if that's part of what's happening, to the extent that it's appropriate and safe, et cetera, tell the truth, or at least some portion of the truth, to those people as best you can. So for me, that's a really important first step that gives traction and soul, let's say, to the other ones. I would say that. Second thing I would say is that we can take comfort in the fact that whatever has been good will always have been good. And whatever is good now is indeed good now, including the good that's deep down inside each person. And that may sound kind of abstract, and for some people it may be simply conceptual, but if you really let it land, the truth of it, you can see it or feel it as clearly as you can feel the weight of the chair as you sit upon it. What's good is good, and it's not tainted or stained or poisoned or taken away by what is quote unquote bad. The next thing, just to finish, I think, that I've just seen is really, really important, is to connect with others. We're social mammals. We evolved in small primate bands. That's our fundamental social unit of about 30 adults that we live with our entire lives. And even though today we live in very different ways, and there are many advantages in being able to connect with others across the country through a technology like you and I are using right now, Victor, that's pretty great. But as humans, we evolved to connect, as we were talking earlier, through touching, through seeing, through being close to other people. And I think when a person has lost their sense of meaning or purpose, including spiritually, it's really important to connect with others. And I guess the last thing I'll just say is I'm a psychologist, right? A fairly sophisticated sort of profession and writing and so forth. And yet I keep coming back to very old school, I call them kind of scruffy values. And one in particular is just practice, the power of practice. I don't mean the power of repetition, like practicing the piano again and again, but more like personal practice. Even without, how can I put it, even without white light, we can see directly that when we pay attention to the sensations of breathing, or when we look out to the stars, or when we sit by the sea, or when we walk our dog in a peaceful way, or when we cuddle our grandchild in our lap, whatever our form of practice is, or maybe go back to church or temple or whatever calls a person, or go out in nature, that those forms of practice, whatever they may be, actually have merit in and of themselves. They have intrinsic value. Maybe we don't have a bright and shining sense of what we had in the past hoped that those practices would bring us to, but in the moment, the evidence is available right there directly that doing that practice, whatever it may be, is worth doing in and of itself.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I saw a presentation by an Army general who gave a presentation to his troops and to the people who were attending this wonderful seminar. And he said, the secret to success in life is make your bed. People were looking and laughing and saying, what does that mean? And he said, if you make your bed first thing in the morning, no matter what happens the rest of the day, when you come home, you'll come home to that made bed and you'll feel a sense of accomplishment.
I think that's so interesting. And I'm reminded, this is a close quotation of something Samuel Beckett, the playwright, said. And here's a creative person who's very engaged in creative activities, including at the highest level in terms of his own profession. And I think the line goes something like, fail, fail, fail again, fail better. That's it. Fails better.
It's the truth. It's the truth. We do have to fall down to be able to get up again. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
What are some other simple ways in daily life that can help people build their resilience?
I think of three, just to really bottom line it. And for me, I just came back from teaching a 10-day meditation retreat, and I've done longer retreats myself as a participant. And I think there's a place for different forms of formal, in-depth, intensive practice of whatever kind speaks to a particular person. That said, it's the little things that we can do every day that really add up, I think. And there's a teaching from the Buddha related to this, a quotation from the Dhammapada, which goes like this. Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. And that's a very wonderful teaching. It's hopeful. It means there's always something we can do, and it takes us to responsibility because it's only we who can do it. So to bottom line, and I think of three things that I would just suggest to people that probably take less than 10 minutes a day. First, as you go through your day, look for those opportunities, a breath here, half a minute there, to slow down and register some authentically beneficial experience. Could be a moment of realizing something about how to work with your own thoughts and feelings. It could be, as I'm doing right now, looking out the window and seeing a hummingbird and some flowers in your backyard. It could be a sense of connection with a friend. It could be a feeling of accomplishment. You finished a tricky email. You got something done. Just slow down and allow that experience to really sink into yourself. Stay with it for a breath or two or longer to help it really wire its own residues into your nervous system as a lasting change in you, so that you will increasingly feel filled up from the inside out as you move through your day. That's the first suggestion. The second suggestion is pick one thing that you'd like to grow more of inside yourself, whatever it might be. Greater patience, greater disengagement from watching the news addictively, being willing to stop at two cookies instead of moving on to the third, a greater sense of capacity for meditative absorption, anything, greater skillfulness at interacting with your spouse, knowing when to shut up and stop interrupting, for example, something I'm still working on. So, that's something. Think of what's your growing edge. Pick one thing that you're working on these days, you're trying to develop, not in a straining sort of way, but in an encouraging way, and then look for opportunities to experience it or factors of it, which then, using the taking in the good processes that I've talked about already and I've written a lot about, then once you're having that experience of what you want to grow, sink into it as it sinks into you. That's the second suggestion I would have. Now we're up to about 5 minutes a day, tops so far. And then the last thing I suggest is that every day for a minute or more, maybe when you first wake up or maybe just before going to bed or at a particular time in the day, you kind of set aside and you protect as a form of sanctuary, sacred ground. You protect taking a minute or two or three or four or five to really reset to what I call the green zone in terms of your three basic needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. Help yourself, including help the kind of soft, furry animal of the body, which is stressed out in the lives of so many people these days. Help the body come back into some authentically available felt sense of enough safety, enough satisfaction, and enough connection so that your mind, so that your body calms down and your mind is colored in terms of those three needs with a sense of peace, contentment, and love. Just kind of help yourself find your way back as best you can. Maybe listen to some music. Maybe look out the window. Maybe just close your eyes and bring to mind things that help you come home to the resting state, the green zone of peace, contentment, and love. And when you do that, As you rest there, neurons that fire together wire together. As you rest in the green zone every day, that is a powerful way, a profound way to build up that unshakable core inside, hardwired into your own nervous system. So that's 10 minutes a day. And if you do it, especially if you do it a couple, 3 days in a row, you'll feel the difference. It's quite dramatic.
Wonderful. You know, just describing what you're talking about, taking satisfaction in some type of accomplishment, I relate that to the taste of a fresh strawberry in my mouth.
There you are.
I don't know why. That just came into my mind.
That's great. Or my version of strawberry is, you know, finishing an email or a paragraph for my next book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What would you like readers to take away from Resilient?
That you really can become stronger, happier, more peaceful, and more loving. You really, 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 really can. There's so much evidence for this in the scientific research literature, and there's so much evidence for it in our own lives. Around us, we see people growing and developing, and we can see ourselves doing this. So we have this power, and it's extremely hopeful, especially in times these days when so many people feel pushed around by big, powerful, even overwhelming political, economic, cultural forces. So that's one big takeaway. And then the other takeaway for me is that it's really possible to deal with the challenges of life without getting upset by them. There's this line from the early teachings of the Buddha that I remember as he was describing his own kind of launch into enlightenment. But he hadn't quite launched yet, but he was on the runway, you know, and speeding up. He said, painful, racking feelings arose. And he was also probably describing pleasant feelings. But they did not invade my mind and remain. That's the key. Feelings arise, reactions arise, understandably, but they need not invade the mind and remain. And it's through growing this unshakable core that we develop ourselves in such a way that we meet the moment with happiness and strength and love rather than the waves of life coming at us and the waves arising in our own neurotic machinery that invade the mind and remain. That's our freedom, and that's our opportunity.
Wisdom from Rick Hansen. He's the author of Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. Rick, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
Thank you, Victor, and it's been a pleasure. RickHansen.net, H-A-N-S-O-N, RickHansen.net. That'll take you to my website. Tons of freely offered resources, including information about my latest book, Resilient.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.